Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is sponsored by LEP Premium. Gain access to over 70 episodes of content, both audio and video, all written and presented by me to help you improve your English. I've got vocabulary lessons, I've got grammar lessons, I've got pronunciation lessons. There are PDFs to download or check in your phone. It's all available in the Luke's English Podcast app. To get started, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium and you can send me an email if you have any questions. It's the price of a cup of coffee every month, about $3 or $4. And then you get access to everything that I've done so far, plus all the new stuff, online, at a computer, or through the Luke's English Podcast app. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this podcast for learners of English. And here is your regular dose of English conversation presented here to help you develop your listening skills and pick up grammar and vocabulary along the way. In this episode of the podcast, you can listen to me in conversation with Ian Moore, who is back on the podcast after a 3.5 year absence. He first appeared in episodes 382 and 383 when we got to know him and talked about mod culture in the UK. If you haven't heard those episodes, or if you have heard them and you need me to jog your memory, here is some background information about Ian, just to bring you up to speed. So Ian Moore is a professional stand-up comedian from England. He moved around during his upbringing and is from a combination of places, including the North, East Anglia, and the London area, as you'll hear during the conversation. He's been described by the Guardian newspaper as one of the country's top comedians, and he regularly performs in the best stand-up comedy venues all around the UK, notably at London's top stand-up comedy club, The Comedy Store, which is just off Leicester Square, where he is a frequent host. So Ian is a mod. Mod is a British fashion subculture from the 1960s, which involves a very particular style featuring certain clothing, like, for example, slim Italian suits, green parka coats, and a lot more besides, riding scooters and listening to American R&B music. Ian is definitely the best dressed guest I've ever had on this podcast, and he came dressed in a three-piece 60s Italian suit, gold watch chain, handkerchief in the pocket with a pin and everything. Ian now lives in rural France on a farm, and he's been living there for nearly 15 years, which is at odds with his mod lifestyle. So he's been living a kind of double life, living on the farm in the French countryside, looking after various animals because his wife keeps introducing new animals into the family, making chutney and commuting to the UK and other cities in Europe to perform stand-up comedy. He's written several books about his double life, which are available from all good bookshops, including Amazon. And that the first one is called À la mode, my so-called tranquil family life in rural France. And the second one is called C'est modnifique, Adventures of an English Grump in Rural France. So as well as writing these funny autobiographical stories, Ian has also branched out into writing fiction, and his first novel, called Playing the Martyr, was published a couple of years ago. It's a crime thriller about an English man who gets murdered in the Loire Valley in France. Now, I don't know if this is based on Ian's life at all. I've got no idea if there have been attempts on his life for some reason. But anyway, the book is well reviewed on Amazon and is available in both Kindle and paperback versions. Ian is also a language learner, French in this instance. He actively works on his French and he passed the language test to gain citizenship in France. So there are plenty of things to talk about. All of that is just background context. And if you'd like to know more, listen to episodes 382 and 383, both of which have transcripts written by the Orion transcript team, available in Google Documents. So check the transcript section of my website to find those. So basically, in those episodes, you can hear a full explanation of the mod subculture, including the clothes, the music, and everything else. Various stories of Ian's rural French lifestyle, including how his children were once threatened, rather shockingly, by a French hunter armed with a shotgun, and other stories. So anyway, this time I decided to see where the conversation takes us, and the result was an extremely tangential and rambling conversation that takes in such things as Ian's favourite films, Ian's recent trip to New York where he did comedy and spent time as a tourist, the complications of Woody Allen's current public image, differences between British and American audiences, differences between burlesque and stripping, Ian's different accents as a child moving from Blackburn to Norfolk to London, details of Ian's clothing, how to iron a shirt properly, which is a lesson that apparently I need to learn, Ian's various health issues and physical complaints and what might be causing them, comedy shows that you can see at the Comedy Store in London, and then Ian's stories about learning French and attempting to pass the language test for French citizenship. So watch out for various little jokes and funny stories along the way, and try to keep up as the topic of the conversation veers from one thing to another. But now let's listen to my conversation with Ian Moore, and here we go. The Aristocats, you're saying that being up here in...
On the Paris rooftops, yeah. It's the Aristocats, isn't it? The Disney film. I'm not talking about the filthy American pseudo-documentary. I'm talking about the Disney film.
The Aristocats.
It's very much where I am more in my comedy. I'm down the Disney end of comedy at the moment rather than the Aristocrats.
I've never seen the Aristocats. Can you remind us what
it's
happens?
A wonderful film. I think the kittens get separated from the mum, or the mum and the kittens get separated from their owner, and they meet an alley cat.
But it's set in Paris.
It's
that's
set
the
in
thing.
Paris, yeah. As all cat films are. All cat films.
Or any
be set
good
in Paris.
Cat films.
Any good cat films. I'm trying to think of another cat film that was set in Paris. But it's great music as well.
I tell you what. Sorry, there is another film, a Disney film set in Paris, but it's not
Ratatouille.
Cats. Ratatouille.
There was a cat involved though.
Is there a cat in Ratatouille?
And it wasn't... Oh, no, that was Basil, the Great Mouse Detective, was set in London. There was a cat in that.
Mm-hmm.
No, Ratatouille was the other Paris film.
Yes. It's in my... I've got this in my stand-up, actually, the Hollywood versions of Paris.
Or there's Charade, which is my favourite film. And it's not Disney.
Charade?
Charade. And that's a film... Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, Walter Matthau, James Coburn...
Ooh.
Set in Paris in 1962, and it's absolutely superb. It's the best film Hitchcock never made. It's a very Hitchcock-style film,
mm-hmm.
and I absolutely adore it. And I watch it possibly twice a week.
What?
I know that sounds
get out of town.
Ridiculous. But every time, say if I finish a gig or I'm up late at night and I go, well, I'm just going to watch something now. Rather than stand around drinking my wine, I need to sit down. So I'll go to bed earlier.
Yeah.
And I put on Charade every time. I've got it on my iPod, on my laptop, on my hard drive. I've got it two DVD versions.
What is it about the film Charade that...
Just sheer class and a world that doesn't exist anymore. It's brilliant writing. It's the two of my favourite actors, four of my favourite actors. A fantastic score. It's directed by Stanley Donen, who also directed Singing in the Rain. It has got everything.
Songs?
No, it's just a theme song, just a soundtrack. But there's a kind of, for me, it kind of represents the end of the golden age of Hollywood. I'm a huge fan of the golden age of Hollywood from the start of talkies until Charade is basically, or Charade, whichever way you want to.
Yeah.
I don't care. It's my favourite film. I'll pronounce it how I want. So from the start of talkies until Charade.
Talkies?
Yeah.
You'll have to explain what that
was.
Well,
when sound came into film, 1927, Al Jolson standing there going, no, wait, 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 you ain't heard nothing yet.
Wait a minute, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. Wait a minute, I tell you, you ain't heard nothing.
That was the first sound heard on film. So that's the start of talking pictures.
Mm.
And so my favourite period of Hollywood is the start of talking pictures until Charade.
Okay, wow. By
so
the way,
27 to 62.
As we go through this conversation, it may be necessary to explain and define as we go.
Hollywood is a place in America.
America is a big country full of crazy
great
people.
Great Satan.
Some of you know it as the Great Satan, and you may be right.
Well, I've just been there, and I was shocked. I'd been to New York. I'd never been to New York, and the reason why I went was basically I booked a holiday because my wife and kids was constantly going on holiday and leaving me alone to look after our stupid zoo.
All the animals you've got?
All the animals. Current count, 14.
14?
Yeah, but I've been away 2 days. That may have changed.
It may have multiplied.
you just never know. Biggest animal is the horse.
Okay.
And when she's around, when she wants to get, you know, fruity, I believe, she once pinned me up against a stable wall.
Really?
And it was... Well, you feel frightened anyway because these are big animals. There's nothing you can do. You can't push a horse. You can try.
Yeah.
But she had me pinned. She just needed some affection of some kind.
She pinned you to the
pinned
wall.
Pinned me against the wall of the stable.
Of the stable. Yeah. Pinned you to the wall.
Yeah, so I couldn't move. I couldn't. She was standing in a way and pressing herself up against me. And it must have looked a right sight when I eventually did escape because I'd just entered the chicken coop and I had eggs in my pocket.
Oh no.
Which had burst and left these horrible stains all over my coat.
So
it was a very odd,
a weird sort of almost romantic encounter with your
it
horse.
It felt romantic.
And you had
in
to clean yourself up afterwards.
You had to, you know, Kleenex.
Yes.
It was a lot of there's a lot of that involved.
So wait a minute. So your family left you alone?
They left me. They'd been constantly leaving me alone for the last 2 years.
Going on holiday.
Well, I say on holiday. They're going to stay with my sister-in-law, who lives down by the Pyrenees, or they go to England and see grandparents and so on. Anyway, I'd had enough. I'd had enough of being left on my own. And I booked a break in New York just for me. Just for me. Mm. And I said, right, Sodger, I'm going. You're going to have to look after your own animals for a week.
What made you choose New York then?
Because I'd never been. I'd never been to New York before. I'd been to America. I've gigged in America before. But I'd always wanted to go to New York. When a lot of my comedy roots, I would guess, would be Woody Allen, which I know is not a very fashionable thing to say. But regarding the fact that he's clearly in some ways a wrong'un,
what do you mean by that?
That he is regarded as a pariah, I guess, in Hollywood circles because of two things. One, he married his stepdaughter, which is there's certainly grey area involved in that.
Actually, when you think about it, there's nothing really wrong with it because they're not.
It wasn't illegal.
He's not marrying his daughter.
No.
He's marrying his stepdaughter.
It's not illegal, but there are some moral issues there that I think probably get forgotten. And also there's the thing about him, the ongoing thing about him allegedly abusing his daughter or stepdaughter.
Yeah, there's now allegations of sexual misconduct.
Which have been investigated twice.
Yeah.
And both times the police have said there's no case to answer, but that... It's still ongoing. My point being that Woody Allen is regarded as a pariah. So when you say you're a Woody Allen fan, that has baggage with it.
Yeah.
It has baggage with it. And I admit, even as an ardent Woody Allen fan, you can watch some Woody Allen films and there are elements of them where you cringe and go, in the light of what we know now, that doesn't work, really.
I can't remember which film it is, but there's one film, I think from the 90s, where he is knocking around with a little girl for most of the film, and it's all a bit weird.
Well, there's Manhattan, in one of his most famous films, where he's basically in his 40s and chasing after a 17-year-old.
Oh, yeah?
So there is there's a lot of it. It's all very easy to look back in hindsight and say things like that. There are things there which do make you cringe. And I'm aware of the kind of the kind of judiciary that operates on social media these days that tends to condemn people and find them guilty before any legal due process has been found. I think the same. You could say the same thing. Has Kevin Spacey been charged or found guilty with anything?
Kevin Spacey is such a weird case, but I don't know if there have been actual legal proceedings yet.
But that's slightly my point, in that his films have all been withdrawn. Yet there is no legal basis for that.
So he's being punished in all sorts of ways in the civil arena.
He's being punished. The whole idea of law is innocent until proven guilty, and at the moment, nothing's been proven as guilty of breaking the law.
Yeah.
And you could go way back it's difficult to, you know, Mozart wasn't a clean living individual by any means. Charles Dickens was awful to his wife and to women. You know, I don't think you can just pull all these cultural things off the shelf because there are things that don't sit easily with how we view things now.
Yeah.
Which is a long way of going about saying I was going to New York.
So you went to New York.
So I went to New York. And it was a kind of film pilgrimage, not just Woody Allen films, but like When Harry Met Sally, and it's another one of my favourite films. But just to be in New York, you know, to wander around and see these things that you feel, in a sense, that you've grown up with, even though you've never been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to spend a few days doing that. And I had the most wonderful time in New York. I did a gig on the last night as well, which was great fun. Just a short gig. It felt really weird. It felt like I'd been there lots of times before. Yeah, yeah. I felt comfortable straight away.
Yeah. So you did a gig at a kind of fairly well-known...
Gotham Comedy Club.
Gotham Comedy Club in New York, not in Gotham City.
No, it doesn't exist.
No. And if it did, like, who would live there? I don't know. But so Gotham Comedy Club, and in front of an American audience.
Yeah.
But not the first time you'd performed in front of Americans.
No, and not the first time. I mean, obviously, working in London, I've performed in front of lots of Americans, but that's a different way you approach it, because they're not in their comfort zone. They're not in their house, if you will. Whereas I'd done a festival in Boston, Boston Comedy Festival, a few years ago, with some big stars, Janine Garofalo and Eugene Merman, which was great fun as well. The first night we did at this enormous theatre in Boston, which was a very good gig, thoroughly enjoyed the gig. And then the next night, because it was a festival, you move from venue to smaller venue and across to the next town. Next time I did the next gig we did, the following night, I was following a burlesque act in a rough bar.
A burlesque act is basically a sort of like, how would you describe it? A glamorous kind of stripper.
More rounded strippers. Shall we say Rubenesque?
So
Rubenesque strippers.
It's like stripping, but on the woman's terms.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Koi stripping.
So it's
that's
teasing.
Not a type of fish. I just mean that it's more teasing. I think that's a very good word
for me. Like if a woman is like a feminist and is about empowerment and all that stuff, she's a burlesque dancer. Whereas if the woman just wants to get some money, and she doesn't care about all the other stuff, she's a stripper.
Right.
See what I mean? Like, burlesque is a sort of like a way for women to do stripping, but it's an empowered form of stripping.
Yeah.
It's like a sort of, it goes back to an old traditional form of entertainment and stuff like that. But I think, don't you think that like a lot of women now are interested in going into burlesque in the same way that they're interested in going to, what is it, sort of...
pole dancing lessons.
Pole dancing lessons, maybe, but also, what do you call women who, some men like to go to these women and they will...
Dominatrix,
right. Dominatrix also is in the world of, like, maybe sex workers and stuff, but a dominatrix is kind of, like, empowered.
So you're...
And so I'm saying that it's trendy at the moment for women to be interested in doing things like being a dominatrix or going into doing... what's the burlesque dancing?
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a more acceptable, empowered form of sexy entertainment.
I guess so. It's a very fine distinction to make. You're still taking your clothes off.
I know.
Taking your clothes off for essentially blokes in a room.
Yeah.
I mean, but I get the distinction and I see what you mean, but there's a fine line.
I think it's there, though. I think the line does exist.
I don't disagree with that. And I think, yeah, I mean, would women say they're doing burlesque or they're doing stripping, you know?
There is a
difference.
Would a
bloke say it?
There's a difference in style, though, as well. Like burlesque comes with a certain types of, like they've always got those big wings made of feathers, which they kind
that's
of
swans.
Are they swans' wings? Is that the idea? And they kind of like, you know, reveal themselves from underneath these feathery wings.
And I don't. I apart from the burlesque show I performed, I don't think I've ever been to a burlesque. So, and it's not full nudity. I think it's more coy than that. It's more sort of carry on. It's more a sort of a hint of eroticism rather than
a full-on sex show of some kind.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway.
I'm so uncomfortable talking about it. Do you know, years ago, I was an extra in a film, and this particular... was it called The Hunger? I can't remember. Anyway, I remember it because it was the day of the semi-final of Euro 96, and I desperately wanted to get out. But we were filming in this strip club in West London, and it was basically a scene in the film where there was strippers on the stage and then blokes sitting at the bar. And I was so shy and really quite young. And the director said, right, you there, you're in this scene, you're the groper. And that's the last thing I wanted to be. I just didn't want to be there. And we had so many takes. And then in the end,
what is a groper?
The groper is a bloke who uses his hands rather than his eyes, and takes unwanted physical affection.
Since we're talking about Woody Allen and stuff like that,
exactly, we're all going one
groping
way.
Is a word that you should know, ladies and gentlemen. That's basically is if you're talking about like the Me Too movement and creepy men who do things they shouldn't do. Touching
you when you don't want to be touched.
Inappropriate touching in the inappropriate areas. This is groping. So anyway, in this movie, which was being,
I was chosen to be the groper in this scene at this strip club. So I'm supposed to, you're not allowed to touch the strippers, but I was supposed to reach out and try and touch the stripper. And we had so many takes, and in the end, the stripper herself complained about me because I was so weak and ineffectual and showed clearly no interest in doing this at all.
Really?
And so they had to drop me as the groper and pick somebody who was up to the job.
A method actor.
Yeah, a proper groper.
I see. Okay, so you went to New York and you performed. I was going to ask, do you feel like American audiences are different to British audiences?
I didn't know, and I wasn't nervous about it in that respect either. I knew that New York is a sophisticated city, and I've worked all over the world in sophisticated cities and know what I'm doing. And the language was never going to be an issue. I just felt confident in it. I'd been there 3 days in New York, and I felt so at home with the place that I didn't feel necessarily that I was out of my comfort zone or out of my own country in a bizarre sense. I felt at home, so I didn't feel any nerves at all.
Do you reckon that's an English American thing?
Possibly. I just think I'd enjoyed myself so much for 3 days that I just felt that this wasn't going to ruin it either. That I was just in complete control of what I was going to say, how I was going to say it. I probably even took the edges off my accent a little bit and made a little bit more English.
Ah.
And went, you know, probably by the end of my set, I was almost full on David Niven. but I really kind of not poshed up a little bit, but just went a little bit more middle class.
Because normally,
than my accent
normally
is.
When you speak, you've got a bit of a sort of.
There's
London
a bit
accent.
Of a Mockney.
There's a bit of
Mockney.
Michael Caine in there sometimes. I don't know. Yeah, Mockney, you call
Mockney.
It.
Mockney is people who pretend to be Cockney. Cockney is the London accent, basically. Specifically, you are born within the sound of the Bow Bells in the East End of London, which I'm not. I'm a northerner.
If you speak like that, right? If you, all right, mate, all right, geezer, do you fancy a cup of tea?
Yeah.
That is Cockney.
It's in effect, that is Cockney.
Basically.
But that's how I tend to be on stage.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not a Londoner at all.
You're from Blackburn.
I'm from Blackburn.
What's a Blackburn?
I normally speak like that. That's my accent from where I was born. It was in Blackburn in Lancashire, yeah.
When did you leave Blackburn?
When I was 7.
Okay. And then you moved to?
You moved to East Anglia.
Yeah.
And I was in King's Lynn, near King's Lynn in East Anglia.
Near
and
Cambridge?
That's east, near Norwich.
Norwich.
Near Norwich.
Norfolk.
There, far out east.
Alan Partridge. North
and,
Norfolk.
And I was, first day at school in East Anglia, obviously I was still speaking like that because I'd just come from Lancashire. And I was beaten up on my first day at school.
Whoa, really?
By the local Norfolkians who regarded my accent as weird. Which in Norfolk, they speak like that all the time. And they thought I spoke stupid and beat me up. And then 4 years later, we moved down south to Crawley. Well, Horsham, and then which is nearer London. And then people spoke with a more estuary accent. They spoke a bit more like this.
Yeah.
But I turned up my first day at school in Horsham speaking like that because I just come from Norfolk. And I got beaten up on my first day at school.
Listen to him. Where are you from?
Yeah. Blackburn.
Via Norfolk. Okay, so when you turn up on stage at the Gotham Comedy Club in front of a room of, what, about 100?
Yeah, about 100. There was on Thursday night, yeah.
Yeah. Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And you
were the smattering of English. There were a few English in there as well.
Okay. And you turn up dressed in a sort of...
I was actually dressed like this. I'm in a three-piece check suit with a gold watch chain and a black roll neck.
A gold watch chain? Is there an actual watch attached?
It's attached to my Prince Albert.
Should
not,
I ask?
It's not.
You're going to have to explain
it's empty.
What that
no, I'm not. Prince Albert is a piercing of the genital area. There's, no, my watch chain is attached to nothing. It could be attached to something.
But it's purely just for this.
It's purely ornamental.
So that it's a very nice, very fetching thing that it comes down from one of the buttons. Is it important which button it comes down from?
Well, as long as it hangs above. No, that's about right because it couldn't go just across. It has to hang. I would say a good 2 or 3 centimeters above the watch pocket on your waistcoat.
So you've got the waistcoat, and say it's quite a high buttoned waistcoat.
Yeah,
because that's the mod style, isn't
with
it?
With a collar as well.
With a collar.
Waistcoat has a collar.
Waistcoat has got a collar. Quite high-buttoned one.
This is a 60s Italian cut.
Yeah.
Three-piece Italian cut.
What's the difference?
Capucci. It's a different style of trouser, for a start. There's no. It's a flat front. There's no pleats, which was different from the late 50s style.
A pleat being
a fold at the front of the trouser.
Which creates a line down the front?
It just creates a fold, almost like a skirt, in a way.
Yeah.
A pleat.
Yeah.
Did I just say that?
Yeah, you did. I did. But I'm just thinking, like,
it's a pleat, mate.
Yeah, a pleat. Yeah, like a schoolgirl's skirt.
Yes.
Yeah, in the nice, in the best possible.
It creates a roll in the fabric, whereas these don't.
All right. I'm just trying to imagine a pleat on a trouser.
Well, 80s, 50s, big sort of zoot suits.
Yeah,
they would have a pleat at the on the trouser.
Those big sort of baggy 1950s trousers. Big suits
and
jazz musicians.
80s kind of new romantic trousers. Okay. They would have pleats on as well
on the side.
No, on the front.
On the front.
On the front.
Okay, so when you turn up on a stage dressed as a mod, right?
Yeah,
and you open your mouth. In your English accent, whether it's you've maybe pushed the sort of the received pronunciation a bit more, or you're still speaking like Michael Caine, as your mobile phone continues to ring. Ian is currently.
I'm really sorry, but I've
struggling.
Got a new mobile phone and I have no idea how it works.
He doesn't
and
know how to turn
it's
it off.
Doing all manner of stuff.
Is that is it? It's a Samsung, is it?
It is.
Yeah.
There you go. That's it.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
So you turn up on stage looking like you do and sounding like you do. What do the Americans think, or what do you know about what they think?
Well, the thing is, they'd all almost been told how to think by the compere, insofar as she went on and she was very good and she got a good atmosphere in the room. I wasn't first on; I was second on, and she said in my introduction, she said. Please welcome this guy all the way from England, and he is the best dressed comedian I've ever seen in my life. And so, therefore, that's set a tone. So you can't then sort of walk obsequiously onto the stage. You walk on. You can't walk on as though you're embarrassed.
Yeah,
have to live up to your outfit.
You got to own the situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what I did, and went straight into my stuff and confidently said, hello, how are you? And then just went into my stuff.
Yeah.
And at no point did I feel like I had to chat to anybody or ingratiate. I mean, there were times that I chatted to the audience during it, but our cultural references between New York, London, New York and London, I'd say, are so similar
yeah.
that there's no real problem in translating anything, for instance.
Yeah. Do you want a glass of water or something? Yeah. Okay. I just got Ian a glass of water and I had water on my hand, listeners, and I just literally just wiped it on my shirt. I am wearing a shirt, which I ironed. Did you? Yeah, I know. It doesn't look like it at all.
At any point
like
this,
I really ironed it hard. And it's still, like, I just can't iron creases out of shirts. Anyway, I just thought I wiped my wet hand on my shirt, and then I thought, oh, my God, this is not something that Ian would do.
Whatever perceptions you have of Luke from listening to this regularly, wiping his hand on his creased shirt probably doesn't fulfill any fantasies you may have.
An extremely creased shirt. How do I get this shirt? How do I get the creases out of this shirt,
Ian? You steam iron that, surely.
Well, yeah, you mean you just put your iron on the hottest setting and you
You spray water onto it as well. You spray water onto the shirt so that it's ironing damp.
Right.
And another way of getting creases out of clothes...
He says...
This is I'm saying this my most Michael Caine way. Another way of getting creases out of clothes, and you learn this from being on the road all the time as a comedian, how you get creases out of suits, for instance, is a good way of doing this, is you when you're in your hotel or wherever you're staying, is you hang your clothes up in your bathroom. Take a really hot shower so the whole room steams up.
Yeah.
And the creases fall out of the clothes.
Ah.
I don't know the physics of science, that, but it works.
Yeah.
It does work.
Okay, so I need to spray water on this.
Hot iron, spray water on it, and then don't wear it again.
So you're very exacting about the clothes that you wear. Do you have the same attitude about what other people wear? Are you judgmental about others'
I think I used to be. I think there's a number of things that change you. In that regard, one, you get older and get more tired of the battle, the battle that you're never going to win.
And you're just like, just wear what you want to wear.
Yeah, what the hell? But also, I've got three sons, and two of them are teenage, and they have very particular tastes. It's not stuff that I would wear or ever have worn. But you know, they're very not belligerent. They're belligerent. They're prepared to argue their case. You know, they respect their dad, but if their dad says, why are you wearing that? They say, because it's X, Y, and Z, and I look better than you. and that's the argument they use. Okay? You know, that's how you've always dressed. You dress how you want to dress. We're doing the same.
Well, you're trying to convince them to wear three-piece Italian suits?
I'm just saying, you know, do you have to show your ankles every time you go out? Is this some kind of ankle competition going on? What? You know, why do you not have any proper footwear? Any footwear that you can polish, for instance?
So, wait, they're going out in trainers with ankle socks and the jeans or trousers are rolled up?
Rolled up.
So the ankles are on display.
The mankles, as I believe they're called.
Mankles, yeah.
They're called mankles.
Man's ankles.
Yeah, I tried that in the summer briefly.
Yeah.
No, it's not a good look.
What were you wearing on your feet?
I had trainers on. I've relaxed in the last couple of years. Well, physical issues have meant that I had to see... I've had back problems for years, and my doctor in France, who hates me anyway, but he recommended I go and see a chiropodist. And the chiropodist,
back doctor?
That's a chiropractor.
Doctor.
Yeah, he said, well, maybe it's because of the way you're walking. Maybe you've got a problem with your feet, and that's going up your spine.
Yeah,
so go and see a chiropodist. And the chiropodist said, can you bring in examples of the footwear that you wear?
You're like, of course.
I said, well, I mean, can I hire a van? I've got quite a lot of footwear. And I turned up at the chiropodist with about six pairs of very delicate loafers and a couple of Chelsea boots. And he looks at me and he goes, do you not wear anything else? I went, no, this is how I roll. And he said, no wonder you got back problems.
So wait a minute. So you've been suffering from various health problems, complaints, including back problems. Could this be a result of your mod lifestyle?
That was the implication that because I'm such a martyr to my own style, to the modernist style, that I've actually damaged myself physically.
So that, you know, the chiropodist is going to suggest changes to your apparel.
And go full on rocker. More leather jackets and more bikers. No, he didn't say that. He said, look, I'm going to give you this kind of semel, as they call it in France. It's an insole.
Yeah. I'm wearing some in my shoes right now. Right. Yeah.
And they were molded specifically for all my footwear, and it's made not the slightest bit of difference.
Yeah. I've got So, listeners, Ian, you're going to love this. So I've got bunions on my toes, my big toes.
Right?
It's horrible. Yeah. So bunions, listeners, are basically swollen joints in your feet. So and they are my big toes.
Right.
Okay. So this causes, I mean, you know, they still look beautiful. Don't worry, everyone.
Nobody's feet looks beautiful. That's the thing. That's the thing. Nobody. Yeah. This is one of those things that's not really discussed. Feet are disgusting.
Yeah, they are weird things,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah.
So anyway, my big toe joints are all swollen and they can be very, very painful. They hurt a lot.
Right.
And also, I think it affects the way I walk as well, potentially, or maybe the toe thing is related to the way I stand and walk, that I favor my right foot. So I stand on my right foot. And if I'm just standing there waiting for the bus, I'll be standing mainly on my right foot. And that means that one of my hips is slightly higher than the other.
Everything's connected, though.
The foot bone is connected
apparently
to the leg
bone. There was a song about this, but everything is connected. The footballer Steven Gerrard, when he first began playing in the first team for Liverpool, he had a number of injuries. And they tried to work out the source of these back and hip and I think it was groin-related injuries. And in the end, they took out his wisdom teeth.
What?
Yeah, they took out his wisdom teeth. And those sort of injuries...
Wait a minute, Steven Gerrard had wisdom teeth?
Not for very long. and he was fine after that. So everything... And I don't know the science of all this, but everything is related. So your wisdom teeth can affect... how you're standing, how your body's adjusting to whatever pain is somewhere else in your body.
Interesting, because I still have my wisdom teeth. They haven't been removed.
I've never had any.
They've never even grown?
Some adults don't have them, do they?
Okay, I don't know.
That speaks volumes for my life.
Well, I mean, I don't know if wisdom is the right word. If you got them, but you didn't get them, and Steven Gerrard did, and I did.
Maybe
I don't know if wisdom...
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. But so potentially the way I stand or the bunions in my feet also cause problems in my neck. So
everything overcompensates.
Yeah, I've got a slipped disc in my neck.
Have you?
Yeah, which plays up sometimes. Recently it's been fine, but every now and then it slips a little bit and it's horrible. I can't move my head at all. But
And that is painful. Back problems are... Have you ever had sciatica?
No, I haven't had sciatica, but my wife's had it. My mum has it.
Man alive.
Yeah, horrible. So, all right, shall we do a section on physical ailments now?
How long have you got?
We've got loads of time. Do you want to go through all the things that have been bothering you in terms of your health?
Okay, well, I'll just say where I am now, because I don't know what's caused all this. Probably lifestyle, but I have currently chronic rheumatoid inflammatory arthritis, psoriatic.
You're going to have to explain every word.
I don't understand any of what I just said. I just know I've got it. Chronic means permanent.
Yeah.
Chronic means it's not going away. Rheumatoid arthritis means an inflammation of the joint. So inflammatory rheumatoid arthritis means an inflammation of the joints, which are very painful, which means I think it's to do with the cartilage, or is that osteo? I'm not sure. Anyway, it's inflammation of the joints.
All the joints?
All my joints. That's why because it's been going on for too long. It's not just... It's all my joints.
Yeah.
Not all always at the same time, but they're all in pain. I've got a double spinal hernia.
Which means slipped discs.
Which means the cartilage on the two of the vertebrae have worn away completely. So it's the discs just rubbing against each other, which is unpleasant.
Yeah.
High blood pressure, which I didn't know about until last week. And I went to see the doctor, not about the high blood pressure, but she said, "You've got high blood pressure."
I'm in a doctor's.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly what I said.
Yeah.
She said, "Are you always this stressed?" I said, "I'm doing a gig in French this week. I am absolutely petrified." Okay. Yeah. And what's the other thing I've got? Oh, I don't know, something else.
You said you had nosebleeds.
Nosebleeds, yeah. Well, that I think that's from... I had a dental implant a couple of years ago, and the French dentists are rough. They are rough as hell.
Tell me about it, yeah.
Oh, man alive. He literally knees on my shoulders with a hammer and tongue going away at me.
Yeah.
And ever since then, he put the implant in, and ever since then, I've had nosebleeds. But I went to the dentist, and the dentist said, "Well, it's not the implant, because it's nowhere near any membrane or anything like that." So I'm going to go and see somebody about that next week as well.
Talking of rough French dentists, I had a lovely rough French dentist experience. So I went to my dentist. She wasn't there, so she was replaced by someone.
Okay, she was replaced. Never a good sign.
No, not at all. She was replaced by essentially a homeless dentist,
okay.
A dentist who doesn't have her own practice. It's just moving from one dentist, yeah. Some one
itinerant
dental
dentist.
Yeah, exactly. Just moving around, like, you know. So that's one thing. And so I normally go to the dentist with my wife. She handles all the French speaking and understanding, and I okay. just provide the teeth.
Right.
I arrived 10, 15 minutes before my wife did. So I went in the chair first, okay. and I laid down. The replacement dentist, who looked like a plastic surgeon's sort of what practice book. Is that right? You know what I mean? Like, basically, she had terrible plastic surgery. I don't know if that had anything to do with it. Really? I didn't know how old she was. She was like an ageless sort of Paul Simon lookalike.
Okay.
Just picture that.
That's quite an image.
Yeah. So she started going at my teeth, and she was, you know, that thing where they clean?
Yeah.
Clean with a metal spike?
A scraper.
Scraper. Yeah. She was scraping. She was scraping my gums a lot. So a lot of gum work. I was bleeding fairly badly from my teeth. And she was going around doing that. She was talking to the assistant in French while she was doing it. And essentially, the from what I could understand, what she was saying was, English people's teeth, you know, so she was going on about English people's teeth. English people's teeth stick out, she was saying. And it's because the alveolar ridge is formed in a different way that their teeth all stick out.
What's the alveolar ridge?
The alveolar ridge is that...
behind your front
just
teeth?
Just behind your front teeth, there is a ridge before...
So on your bite? Is
it the... Yeah, so when you make a t sound,
yeah.
The tip of your tongue touches that ridge.
Okay.
So you've got the alveolar ridge, then behind that is the soft palate, they call it.
Right.
These are all things you learn when you learn about pronunciation and stuff.
Right.
So she said the alveolar ridge is formed differently and it pushes the teeth out. And then afterwards... After I was like checking out the blood coming out of my mouth in the mirror and stuff, and my wife was chatting to her. She was going, "Oh yeah, English people don't like to have their teeth done, and all this stuff." Like, what the what are you talking about?
Well, not with a spike, so they're bleeding as you come out.
Yeah, no. I don't like to.
Likes that?
What you mean is when you say English people don't like to have their teeth done, is what you mean is that English people don't like to be stabbed in the teeth while being racially abused.
She's probably got a point.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. English people don't like that. But anyway, it was pretty bizarre. And yeah, like the worst treatment I've had. Like my gums are all like purple around my teeth and they're all bleeding and stuff. It was horrible.
Did you have to pay for that as well?
Well, yeah. It's like partially refunded, but also you have to pay for some of it too. I mean, the teeth were clean, but also a lot of my gums were clean too. I don't know
there's something about medics, and I think in France that they are highly qualified, and you know, everybody needs them and stuff, but they just make arbitrary decisions without your consent at times. I took my kids to the dentist, and this is how I found out that I needed an implant in the first place, because I had a crown on my front tooth. I'd had it kicked out playing football years ago and had a crown put on. And I was in the dentist, and the kids had been seen too, and I just said to him, I said, "I'm having a problem because my crown's loose, or it feels loose. Maybe I'm just, you know, it's 20 years since I had it done. Maybe it's just, you know, past its sell-by date or whatever." And he said, "Sit down in the chair." 5 minutes later, I'm lying back in that chair, and he has done, to show to my kids that there's a crack in my crown, he's put a syringe needle from the inside of my mouth so it's sticking out.
God.
My kids are now screaming, going, "What have you done to Daddy? He's got a metal spike sticking out of his mouth."
Yeah.
And he said, "There you go, you see, I'm just showing you that your crown is fractured and you need to get it changed quickly or your face will collapse."
So you could have just told me that. You didn't need to demonstrate.
Didn't have to demonstrate that to two very young boys at the time who are even now having nightmares about the whole thing.
Oh, wow. Okay, so like little health complaints and things. Could this be as a result of your mod choices in life?
I don't know if it's mod choices. I don't know why I've got all this stuff at the moment. I think that it's possibly a result of... I've lived in France for 15 years. So for 15 years, almost every week, 90% of the time, I've been commuting backwards and forwards between the UK, to gig in the UK and to live at home in rural France.
On the Eurostar
or on budget airlines or in a car or sometimes a bus. I made it an almost a mission that I wouldn't have the same journey 2 weeks in a row. I couldn't have the same journey 2 weeks in a row because then it would make it, it would feel like a commute. And I didn't want that kind of laborious ennui. I didn't want to feel like I was being forced to go where I was going. So I made sure that the journey was different every week. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't do it every single week, obviously, but you'd know two consecutive weeks were the same journey. But that meant a lot of faffing around. It meant getting up at crack of dawn to come home. So I always made a point of, again, needing to come home as soon as I possibly could. So I'd be getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and waiting in a cold bus station with a heavy bag over my shoulder. And that takes its toll.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Physically, that takes its toll. I think mentally, it takes its toll. And mentally, that has an effect on your body. You run out of energy. You run out of the energy to be able to recuperate, especially when you're doing it every week.
How long have you been a professional stand-up comedian or touring stand-up comedian?
A touring stand-up comedian, I would say 22 years, 23 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time. It's a long time on the road, living out of cases, you know.
Yeah. Do you what kind of bag do you have?
I have got the world's greatest bag.
I bet you do. I bet you've got a very stylish bag.
I absolutely love this bag. I bought this bag when we first moved to France, and it's a Samsonite. They don't make it anymore. It was a Samsonite. It's almost like a TARDIS. The TARDIS is the Doctor Who spaceship, so it's bigger on the inside than it looks on the outside.
Right.
And it's a very small, what looks like a very small case, but it folds out triple wires.
Ooh.
On the back, there's a back pocket that folds out triple wires, so I can get two suits in there, and they'll barely crease, fold them back up, and then you've still got the case in the front like that.
Wow.
And it's so good because it's black and it doesn't look very big, so nobody's ever stopped me and gone, that's too big for cabin luggage, which it is. And because you wear it over your shoulder and you don't have to wheel it around like a loser. I hate wheelie cases.
Ah. But carrying a bag over your shoulder is one of the worst things you can do to your back.
Yes.
So I used to do that. So I used to always carry my bag over my shoulder. And when I was working at university for a few years, I used to carry this big leather. It was a really nice leather, like a real leather sort of large satchel.
Yeah.
And I used to carry it over my shoulder and I had all the exam photocopies in there, all my students' exams, and often it would be very heavy and I'd be slinging it over my shoulder, and I suffered so much during that period with like the bad neck and everything. And
I'm no medic, but that's probably what's giving you bunions.
What?
That bag.
Yeah.
That original bag. Everything's connected.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was saying it earlier, that is either giving me the bunions or the bunions are giving me the neck or all of it's because of the way I favour one leg when I stand. So now it's like, now I've entered the second phase of my life. Yeah. Well, the first half of my life, I stood on my right foot. Now I'm standing on my left foot now.
That's that made a difference?
The defining feature.
Because I was told, I went to see a physiotherapist in France, and he was a lovely bloke from Belgium. And he said, what do you do for a living? And I'm stand up. And he said, well, that's, for one, that's tough on your back. You are standing while you're working, right?
Yeah.
So he says, how do you stand? And I kind of showed him, and he said, well, you're favouring your left leg. So the next time you do a gig, I want you to favour your right leg. And it didn't work.
It didn't work.
No humour in that at all. I tried to get 20 minutes out of just standing on my right leg.
Standing on your right leg, no one laughed.
But it felt odd.
Yeah.
It felt the choreography of how I had been doing stand-up for 20 years by that point just felt slightly odd.
It's an interesting question, because as a comedian myself, I don't have the same level of experience that you do, but often before a show, I'll think about little details like that. Like, my mind gets plagued with all sorts of extraneous details, like, for example, what kind of clothes I'm going to wear and how I stand on stage. So for me, the best gigs are when I'm actually moving while I'm talking and everything's quite fluid and I'm moving around a lot. And then the worst gigs, I realize I'm
you're rigid.
I'm stuck to the spot and I'm rigid. And the worst is when I realize, oh shit, I'm just stuck to this spot and I'm really, really rigid. So I'm going to move now. And then you move and it's like a really awkward move and it doesn't work.
I think a lot of comics, when they first start out, get kind of bogged down in that stuff as well. And I think one of the things you can do to try and make that less of an issue is to do comparing, where you are forced to address the whole room and forced to use whatever stage you have to move over to the right if something's going on, to move over to the left. It forces you out of yourself, and to use the area that you've been given.
Yeah. I actually like doing the large stages that I've done sometimes when I'm usually performing on someone else's show,
right?
Like with Paul, for example, and I'll get the chance to perform on quite a wide stage in front of a large audience. That is amazing because you get to like walk from one side to the other, and it's brilliant. Like the first, it's wonderful because the first thing you do, you come out, you get the microphone, you start pacing up and down and sort of addressing everyone.
Yeah.
That is amazing, and then you're walking and talking, and it's really, really good. And
it's very liberating as a stand-up as well, and you can, it helps the performance of your material. You get more out of your material and you realize there's more in your material because you're forcing yourself to be more physical. And if you can get material, isn't just about being verbal or just being physical, it's about matching up the two things.
Yes.
And a big stage obviously gives you the opportunity to do that, but comparing does that as well.
But this Belgian guy, anyway, was saying that stand-up is very bad for your back.
And basically, he was saying that.
All right.
My entire lifestyle.
Yeah. Your entire lifestyle is bad for you, bad for your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you're still doing stand-up quite a lot in London. If any of my listeners, and I have had some listeners who've come to London and gone to a comedy show, and I always recommend the Comedy Store because it's my favourite one.
It's the best club in the world.
So the Comedy Store in London, is it Leicester Square?
Yeah, just off Leicester Square.
Yeah. Always my recommendation for going to see stand-up in London. Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, those are the three.
Those are the pure stand-up nights.
Yeah.
And then on a Sunday and Wednesday, there's improv, world-famous improv. And on a Tuesday, there's what they call Cutting Edge, which is topical news.
Uh-huh.
Topical news programs.
And Monday's the Gong Show, isn't it?
Monday's, the last Monday of every month is the Gong Show, which is pitiful.
It's horrible.
To explain what the Gong Show is, it's an opportunity for people who've never really done stand-up before to go onto the stage at the Comedy Store and try and last long enough before they're gonged off.
A gong is like a big, like a bell, kind of flat bell.
Yeah, dinner gong.
Bong, like that. So, so basically the as a performer, the Gong Show is quite legendary, certainly in the open mic act scene.
Yeah.
And once you graduate to the professional stuff, is like...
If you can get through that, you're doing extremely well. But if you don't get through that, it is no way a reflection on your skills as a comedian. It's a night in and of itself.
It's quite brutal.
I think I may have
mentioned it on this podcast before because I spoke to Rob and I think he did the Gong Show.
He did the Gong Show when I was compere.
Right. So let me just explain what the Gong Show is just so my listeners understand exactly. So as a performer, you go up and you've got a maximum of what, 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay. But the first 2 minutes... you're being judged, so...
No, you're judged through the whole thing.
All the way through the 5 minutes.
You're judged the whole thing.
So you do the whole...
The gong could go off at any point in that moment. 5 minutes.
So you go up, you've got 5 minutes, you start doing your material in front of the audience, and red flags have been passed out.
There are three judges in the audience who have red cards, effectively, a bit like football, and they can hold them up at any point to say that they want you off the stage. And once all three judges have made that decision... I then gong the gong, and you have to get off the stage.
Okay, and some people last a matter of seconds, don't they?
Oh, literally seconds.
Some
but then, you know, because it's such a brutal thing. I remember I was doing it once, and I in no way think this is big or clever, but there was some guy, I knew he'd come all the way from Australia to perform at the Gong Show in London, and he jumped onto the stage, but he was wearing flip-flops, and I banged the gong straight away. I will not have any form of beach leisure wear on the greatest comedy stage in the world.
And Is that what you said afterwards?
2.5 seconds.
So you can see how brutal it is, ladies and gents. You can come up and literally your appearance can get you either all three red flags or a gong, and you have to walk away, or you go up and your first joke doesn't go down very well and you get a couple of red flags, and then before you know it, you're flagged off. I've never done the Gong Show.
I think it's quite a spectacle if you're in the audience and no vested interest.
Yeah.
But like I say, it is not a judgment on anybody's comedic ability if you fail or even get through. to be so honest.
So that's Monday night. And so essentially, I always recommend to my students that if they go to London, they want to see comedy, they go to the Comedy Store. And some of them have. Some of them have definitely gone at the weekend, so they may have seen you comparing. Mm-hmm. So you're there sometimes doing the emceeing at the Comedy Store still in London?
Yeah, about three or four times a year.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the best show in the world. It's you know, it's when you're comparing what is the best comedy stage in the world with, you know, some of the top acts. It's such a buzz. You know, there's no finer feeling in stand-up for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got several other things left that I wanted to talk to you about before we end.
Okay.
So one of them is, shall I bring it up? The B word?
We should do the thing about language learning.
Yeah, okay, let's get into that then. Yeah. So as an English person living in France... You've been learning. Have you been learning French? Have you been actively applying yourself to learning the language?
I did and I didn't, and I tried various ways of doing it. And in the end, because for most of the time I've been living in France, I've only been here half the week. I was just too tired, you know, and didn't make the proper effort that I should have made. And also, you know, we tried various things at home to try and artificially force us to speak French at home, which we don't. We speak English at home mainly.
Your wife is French.
My wife's she's half French. She's
bilingual.
She's more French than English. Mm-hmm. And the kids are all French and English. And you know, we tried to do this thing, but where we forced the French, and it never worked. One of my kids actually said to me, "Daddy, I don't want to speak French at home when you're here, because when you're at home, we want to be able to understand what you're saying," which is a brutal assessment of my language skills, basically. But then with Brexit and all of, I decided the day after Brexit that I had to become French. I knew that with the personalities involved in Brexit and with the promises that were made with Brexit, that it would turn out to be an utter, utter shit show, and I had to take steps to protect my family. I was genuinely, genuinely concerned that at some point we could be split up as a family.
Basically, you're like Liam Neeson on this.
I am. I'm slightly better dressed.
I'll do anything to protect my family. I'll even become French.
Paris, exactly. Exactly. But I was genuinely, genuinely scared that with the kind of talk that was coming out of Britain, in that we don't want EU immigrants, or if there are EU migrants, then they have to have an earning threshold. If not, then they have to leave. Now, if that was reciprocated in France, I wasn't earning any money in France. I was earning all my money outside of France. So I would be subject to that kind of reciprocal arrangement. So my family could stay or I could go. And anyway, the fear grew. Yeah. And so I made the decision the day after the Brexit referendum that I would try and get the French nationality. And the first thing you have to do to get French nationality, the first hurdle you have to jump over, is to pass the French language test. It's the it's the TCF. It's the Test de Connaissance de Française or Français.
There's a few different names for it.
They all have the same kind of European level of minimum level that you have to achieve.
It's based on the European Framework of Common Reference for E. God, I know that acronym off by heart.
You should do.
European Reference of European Common Framework of Reference, ECFR. And so, yeah, the requirement is that you have a minimum B1, which is basically an intermediate level of French, which is like, you know, the basic stuff that you
school
need.
School stuff, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, it's GCSE, maybe even less than that.
But as ever with these things, and my French is better than that. And I'd really learned. I'd really put in the effort. All I did was listen to French radio. I'd made a massive effort and made, you know, an effort to get out of my comfort zone as well. Mm-hmm. To go out and speak to people and just speak more French.
And perform in French.
And perform. I've done a few gigs in French now, which is utterly terrifying. Utterly terrifying. So we sat down, we had to fill in the application form to take this language test. And my wife actually said to me, she said, "Shall we put you down as a mute?"
a mute is somebody who can't speak. You think that would be better than...
I think we were scrabbling around for anything that would mean I could avoid having this French language test.
Right, I see.
You know, so she said, if we put you down having some kind of language disability, maybe they'll just wave you through.
They'll let you through, if you do that. Of like, I'm sorry, and he's deaf, dumb and blind.
Yeah, he plays pinball, but very little else. that's a reference to The Who, by the way, Pinball Wizard. And we said, no, you know, we can't avoid this. We can't avoid this thing. I have to go through it. And I turned up at I took my test in Tours, which is not far from where I live. And the first part of the test was like a 25-minute listening multiple choice.
Yeah.
And everybody else in the room was already a French speaker. They were all from former colonies of France, African colonies of France, all North African states.
Yeah.
So they spoke French, but they were just going through this kind of... They had to go through the same hurdle I had. And even they were all standing around after the test going, man, that was hard, wasn't it? Oh, God, stop listening after about 2 minutes.
When I did that, so I did exactly the same thing as you, and I was there doing the computer-based test for 25 minutes, struggling and stuff, and it reveals your score at the end.
I didn't have that.
Revealed my score on the screen afterwards. And I came out as B1 in the listening, which I was very disappointed by, because when I've been practicing it, like listening, understanding people is the thing I can do. Like I can't do most other things, but
responding,
I can't respond. No, I can understand what people say. I don't know how I can understand what they say, Ian, because I don't really know any words or grammar. So I don't know how I'm understanding them. I think I just use the force. I use the Jedi mind trick. To understand people when they speak French, because I literally can't be like, okay, and that word.
But that's because you're seeing them as well, and there's a rhythm and to how people
context.
Talk, and absolutely, but facial expression and all of that, and you can gauge question or answer or rhetorical question or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, if it's just a listening comprehension, all of those weapons that you have are taken away from
much
you.
Much more difficult. And so anyway, I was listening to it, and not, you know, normally in my practice listening test I've been doing at home, I was coming out pretty good, and a lot of the time I was like C1, which was amazing. That's advanced.
That's
I was
good.
Like, bloody hell, how am I managing this?
Yeah.
And then in the actual exam, of course, being in the exam room, the tension, I didn't know where to look. I couldn't find my comfortable zone. I realized that my mind was drifting and like it was really hard to focus. And so I knew I was answering questions knowing that I was getting them wrong. It's like, oh God, this is a nightmare. In the end, it came up B1, which is, you know, the
that's the minimum requirement.
I looked around at the other screens as people were leaving, and I glanced at the other screens. C1, C1, C2, 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 C2. All these other people, you bastards!
But I mean, we didn't have that. Ours wasn't computerized. Ours was just pen and paper. So I didn't even. I didn't have that luxury that I'd actually passed. I thought
out there in the countryside, it's a different story.
Chalk and slate where I was.
But I didn't get the result until later. The result of my listening thing came up.
Yeah.
And then I had to do the speaking thing, which I talked to you about earlier, which was horrible. But amazingly, I got B2 in the speaking. Even though it all went wrong, I ended up with B2. I must have done so well in the first two. Or she was I was so nice. I was like, I made a point of you know, doing the French thing, which they like a lot, which is that
you kissed her on both cheeks.
I tried.
Over familiar?
That wasn't appropriate, unfortunately. But that was before they pressed record on the tape machine. But no, I tried to be very polite, you know, and do all the things they expect. I made an effort. I ironed a shirt more than this, better than this.
I hope so.
Yeah. But it was so awful. But maybe I survived. And it, for me, like the last 3 minutes of the test were an absolute disaster. But maybe I'd got to the B2 point before it all went wrong. I don't know. But I got B2 from that. So I got B1 in the end, overall.
I think I got B2. I can't remember. I think it was B2. It wasn't, you know, I'm not going to be employed by UNICEF as a translator in any in the upcoming weeks, that's for sure. But I had my disasters during the whole thing.
How was your speaking test?
Well, it was awful. It was just, I still, even now, wake up sweating and going, why? Why did you do that? Because as you know, the first part, there's three parts of the speaking test. The first part is you just have to introduce and talk about yourself. That's easy. I mean, you know, we can do that. The second part was a role play where the examiner gives you a role play. The examiner then leaves the room, and so you've got 2 minutes to prepare. She comes back, he or she comes back into the room, presses record, and you begin the role play. And that, for me, was...
Maybe I was overthinking it. Maybe I was just looking for laughs. I don't know. But the role play that the examiner gave me was, I'm going away for a month. I'd like you to look after my dog. And the idea from that conversation start, is you then have a chat about the whole thing, maybe the logistics of whatever. Anyway, she left the room. I prepared. She came back in. She pressed record on the machine and she said, I'm going away for a month. I'd like you to look after my dog. And I said, I don't want your dog. And her face just fell and she pressed stop on the record and said, you must have the dog. And we had this kind of row for about 5 minutes over whether I had to have the dog.
But she wasn't.
And then she pressed record again during this conversation. Yeah. So it was clear that yeah. I'd decided I wasn't going to change my position on the whole having the dog thing.
Yeah.
So she decided to just record and go with it.
The argument.
Yeah. So maybe I was very French in that argument. I have no idea.
Surely, it's
default, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the default thing. I'm surprised you were so unprepared for that.
I'm sorry I don't want your dog. I'm on strike that week.
Yeah, I'm allergic to dogs. Now
yeah.
what?
Yeah, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Don't go on holiday.
Because I would imagine that she, like, probably, were you doing it for laughs? You were, weren't you? You were.
I don't, you see, you were. This is the thing. A part of you as a comedian, and I was having this conversation with another comedian the other night, and that part of you is going, just play it straight. There is nothing to be gained here by being clever or even trying to be funny. Mm-hmm. There really is nothing here. But equally, there was nothing on that piece of paper that said I had to have this bloody dog.
I don't even know you. I just met you 1 minute ago. You're my French examiner, and now you're trying to get me to look after your dog?
Is this some kind of bribe? What, I get my nationality if I look after your dog? What the hell's going on? Anyway, we moved on to the third part of the TCF examination, the oral part of it, which is the most French part because it's the most it's what I called the dinner party part of the
yeah.
of the exam, in that it's the kind of philosophical open-ended question that would be thrown out around a French dinner table, and then would just the next few hours would just be whiled away as various people had various opinions on whatever the subject is.
Everyone gets their turn as well. Everyone gets their
yeah.
spot.
Yeah.
So at a French yeah. dinner party where you get your moment to like say what you've got to say and everyone will yeah. listen to you, but you speak for like 5 minutes or something
yeah.
about this thing and you give your opinions, you present your philosophical, yeah. What's the word for it, problematic
yeah.
to them. To your co-eaters, and okay. So, what was yours then? What was your question?
My question was, and apologies for the French accent, but that's how it is. Peut-on connaître des pays à travers le livre? Now that, as I know now, that translates as: can you know a country across their literature? Can you know a country through their literature?
Yeah.
And I knew that peut-on connaître des pays, can you know a country? And I knew le livre, I knew their literature. The à travers thing in the middle,
mm-hmm.
that connecting thing, just
through,
yeah. just literally threw me.
Hey!
There you go.
It's different spelling, folks. You know, through, spelled T-H-R-E-W, the past participle of throw, which sounds the same as the preposition through, T-H-R-O-U-G-H. That is where the joke comes from, ladies and gents.
There you go.
Okay, now we
there
can
you
see.
Go. But for me, for à travers, and I was thinking, I don't know this. I don't know à travers. Where there must be something. And I was, you know, when you're really scrabbling around and going through your kind of French word Rolodex, spinning in your head. À travers, I couldn't get it, and then it came. Travers, barbecue ribs.
Travers means barbecue ribs.
Travers is a word is barbecue ribs. So I thought suddenly this light bulb went off above my head. Can you know a country from their outdoor cooking books?
Yeah.
And I just went on for about 5 minutes about outdoor cooking in various countries.
Like if that country is Australia, then the answer is yes.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know. And she was just looking at me like, this bloke's insane. He not only doesn't want my dog, but he thinks that this is all about outdoor cooking and barbecue ribs.
She's going, oh, les Anglais, quoi, le Brexit, quoi.
They're obsessed with roast beef, these people.
Yeah, cooking and, outside.
And I came out of that room, and then it hit me about what à travers was, and I just felt just so stupid. She must have thought it was secretly being filmed or something like that, that I was some kind of setup. And I was just crushed. I was literally crushed. And then I got a letter about 2 weeks later, which said, I thought you have attained the TCF that you need. And it wasn't that at all. I can't remember what the French verb is, attendre, something like that. But basically it just meant, well done, you turned up. It was basically a letter confirming the fact that I'd taken the bloody exam, not that I'd passed it.
That's it.
Yeah, I'm jumping up and down, going, and I was actually at work at the Comedy Store, and it came through via email, and I forwarded the email to my wife saying, "Hey, you know, we passed," and she just emailed me back saying, "No, you just turned up."
Because
well done.
In France, if something is not on paper, then it didn't happen.
Absolutely.
So it has to be put on paper just to, so everyone's got a record that you did attend the thing, so that blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I mean, I told you about mine earlier. I have mentioned it on the podcast before, but it was horrible. Just like missing one word, word I didn't understand threw me completely. I mean, I'm not really capable of doing that 5 minute talk at the dinner table anyway. But I didn't really understand the question. So I managed to produce about three sentences before I just basically shut down. I went into kind of low power mode, you know, like when the batteries run out on a device and it's just kind of going, bup, 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 you know, like just ticking over, like there is some residual electricity in there somewhere. So I was just like, in a perpetual state of, I'm about to say something. I'm about to say something brilliant. And then the time ran out and cause I didn't understand a word or something. And then, as I was saying to you earlier, I was sweating so much. The sweat was pouring off me because I will sweat if I'm nervous, if I'm put on the spot, I just start sweating. It's really weird. And it was July. So it was boiling hot. So I was pouring sweat pouring, dripping off my nose during this test. I don't think she noticed maybe the level of French because she was so distracted by the perspiration. The liquid that was exiting my body was like more interesting than the French that was coming out. And so I, at the end of the test, she switched off the recorder and I said to her, "Ooh, part three was difficult," I said in French. And she said to me, "Oh, no, that's okay. We've got a lift from the third floor." And I was like, thank God that wasn't in the test.
Just finding your way out of the room. Part four of the oral examination.
She didn't understand what I had said because I probably said something complete, some absolute shit to her. And she had taken one look at me and the context of "this man is hot" overrided any other potential communicative factor, so that the only message she understood from that was, "I am hot. I don't want to walk downstairs because it will be uncomfortable." She's like, "Oh no, don't worry. There's a lift from the third floor."
She clearly felt sorry for you.
Yeah, though. She did. Yeah,
I mean, you'd won her over, whereas this woman hated me.
I did win her over. I'm very good at doing that, at finding ways of sort of failing, like graciously, right. nobly kind of collapsing in front of people, and then they take pity on me.
Yeah.
That's most of my French interactions are that, where I'm like, I go to the post office and I'm like, right, so in English it's like, "Good day, madam, I have this package which I have to send back to this company. Can you please talk me through the necessary steps?" And here it's like, "I have package I generally start sentences and wait for them to finish them. And then if they're right, I'm like, yes. If they've got the wrong sentence, and then I go, you know, it's terrible. It's a total disaster.
It's debilitating, isn't it? Because we both speak for a living as well.
Yeah.
And I find it, and my wife has said this, that and my in-laws have said this as well, and my mother-in-law's French, and that I've now reached a level of French where my personality is actually able to show.
Oh, I'm far from
which that. Is not necessarily a good thing. And we've fallen out with lots of family since that has happened. I was just the quiet, polite bloke at the end of the table before this. Now they know that I can be a right shit.
Well, I was saying to you earlier that, like, well, first of all, I don't know how I understand people. I think it's the Jedi mind trick. And secondly, what was it I was saying earlier? That's it. What I was saying to you earlier is that I've realised that, first of all, I'm a good teacher, right? So I've been teaching for 20 years. So I'm a pretty good English language teacher, and I know what I'm doing. And I'm a good teacher, but I'm a bad learner.
Right.
So I find it's better, it's more effective if I can just teach people the English that I need them to know for that particular transaction than for me to try and speak French. So it's like, let me just teach you English for this situation, and then we'll move on. You know, that seems to be more effective.
If you could do that for roughly 60 million people living in France on an individual basis, you won't have to learn French anymore.
That's essentially what I'm doing. I'm attempting to teach the French English so I don't have to learn French.
One by one. Might take a while.
Yes, I know.
I've found, because I've had to use French a lot more since I set up the Chambre d'Hôte in the Loire Valley.
This is your guest house.
This is the guest house where we live, so that I don't have to go travelling every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was supposed to be a fallback for the Brexit thing if I didn't get the nationality, because I was told I wouldn't get the nationality anyway. I had a police interview, one of many police interviews, more police interviews than most other people who've had.
Police interviews?
To get the nationality thing. Yeah. I had armed police turn up the door and want to see my papers and rifle through some drawers and stuff. I was called into another police interview in Tours, and then I had another police interview in Châteauroux, which I don't know what that was about, but... we were talking about the nationality. They're trying to find out your motives for why you want to become French, basically. And we talked about it, and you know, my French isn't great, but this policewoman was really lovely and really, really quite sweet and very understanding. And she said, "Look, I'll recommend you to get the nationality." And I said, "That's very kind of you." And then she said, "But you won't get it." And I said, "Sorry, I don't. What do you mean? Why wouldn't I get it? If you're recommending it for me to go forward for that, why would I not get that?" And she said, "Because it's your first time. Meaning, this is France. Nobody gets anything the first time they apply for it. You know," she said, "it's like a driving license. Nobody passes first time. You have to go through the whole process again."
Mm.
I mean, I did get it, but. Because I didn't think I would get it, I had to have a fallback, like I said, which is why we set up the Chambre d'Hôte, the B&B where we are, so that I am earning money in the French system, so that wouldn't be an issue. As I said earlier, with reciprocal rights between the UK and France and the EU. And what I found is that I'm forced to interact with people, you know, more than I normally would. You know, and chatting to people.
Oh, because of the guest house.
Because I'm, and the French especially, the idea of a chambre d'hôte with the French is not just a B&B. This is not just where we're laying our head down for the night. We're at breakfast, and this is a breakfast table, and that means you stay and you chat to us.
You know,
who are you? Why are you English? Why are you here? Why have you set this up? What's this about?
Yeah.
And it's helped enormously.
Why are you English?
Why are you English? What on earth? What kind of decision was that you made at a very early age before you'd thought it through at all?
Yeah.
But it's helped enormously. And also gigging in French. When I gigged in French a couple of weeks ago, I was absolutely, absolutely terrified of it. I felt I hadn't prepared enough, even though I had. I just felt that it was so far out of my comfort zone that I was just going to fall down flat on my face, which is, if anything, I'm about no loss of dignity. That's if somebody should put that on my tombstone. At least he didn't lose dignity.
Yeah.
And the gig went really well. And it gave me the confidence then, if I can stand up in front of French people using their language and get laughs out of that, I can order a bloody coffee without trying to make, you know, looking like an idiot, you know, and I've got far more confidence in the last month than I had before that, you know. I'm willing to, you know, we were in that cafe downstairs where point blank they refused to speak French to us.
Yeah.
Even though you were speaking English to them and they were speaking English to both of us. And then when I went to pay, I just insisted on speaking in French.
Did they speak French to you?
She responded in French. Eventually, I wore the woman down. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, my listeners might be tremendously disappointed to learn that I'm not a great learner of French, because obviously I'm an international expert in language acquisition and a guru of language learning and all that stuff. But, you know, I don't necessarily apply to
but
myself.
But I don't think that's – even if we were both fluent in French – they would still have spoken to us in English in that bar.
That's because
Paris.
They've designed that bar is they're meant to speak English in there, because the owner has gone, okay, so we get a lot of tourists around here. I only want staff who can speak fluent English.
Really?
And so if you hear someone who's like an English speaker, an Anglophone, please speak English with them. Please use your English, because we're not like those cliched French waiters who refuse to speak English. We will speak English.
I've never met a cliched French waiter in that case. And they all speak English.
They all do speak English, yeah. They pretty much do. But certainly more and more, I feel like it's becoming a thing where I'll go into a place, like usually quite a trendy spot near here.
Yeah.
Not that I'm always going to trendy spots, but I'll go into some nice cafe or shop, right, yeah, on the street, on the road, and I'll say bonjour, and they immediately can just,
yeah,
he's English, and yeah, they're like, hi, how are you doing? And like, damn, which part of bonjour was wrong? And you know,
it's disheartening, though, isn't it?
Well, I'm, you know, I then just switch to English because, you know, that's just
I'm more stubborn.
Yeah, I've got to be more stubborn. I'm not stubborn enough, and I'm too agreeable. And
I've never been accused of being agreeable.
Well,
sometimes I had an appointment with a gastroenterologist. I'm not going to go into details about this. It's far too mucky. But I had an appointment with a gastroenterologist recently, and she was in Francis's, and she was Romanian. And her French was not perfect, and all the textbooks, all the gastro textbooks in her office were in English. One of them was called Failed Reflux Therapy, which seems like an odd textbook to have. Can you get one which has good news?
Failed Reflux Therapy.
Who wrote that book? Look up, not down.
Here are all the things that you shouldn't do, okay? You should probably start by reading this.
So bizarre.
Yeah.
And on her desk, she even had a box of After Eight Mints, which is such a very English box of chocolates. It's a very Christmas-related, yeah, box of chocolates.
Yeah.
So it's clear that she spoke English. And her French wasn't great, and my French isn't great. So, we both battled through,
yeah,
like it was a war that we had to see through to the end.
Because the person who switches to English first is the loser.
Is the loser,
yeah. I'm such a loser, because now actually I'm not a loser, because they always switch to English, and then I'm like, okay,
you can walk away from that going, well, if you don't want me to use my fluent French, that's, you want to learn, that's fine.
So the joke I always say, and I've said it many times, is my French is not going very well, but my excuses are getting better all the time. I'm fluent in excuses.
That's very good.
Okay, well, look, I could talk to you for ages, but we have to stop at some point. It's been an hour and 15 minutes. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
For coming back on the podcast for the first time in about 3.5 years.
Was it? It was pre-Brexit, wasn't it?
3.5 years ago, pre-Brexit. We talked about it a little bit, but
yeah. I think I was more optimistic about it then.
Should we just not talk about it?
I think it's best not to. Now I'm French, I really don't have to have these worries anymore.
Yeah, but it's still a disappointment, isn't it?
It's like it is. There's one other thing, and I'll just say this briefly about it. When I was in one of the interviews I had for my nationality thing, one of the questions is, how French do you feel? You know, and basically you've got to then come out with a spiel about,
very French.
You know, I wear onions around my neck on any weekday when I'm not working, but I just felt maybe this is me being honest and it actually working for a change. I just said I feel European, and I feel more European than I do British, and I think that the values of Europe are the values that were taken from the rights of man and from the French Revolution, and in that respect I feel more French,
yeah,
than I do English or British.
Yeah.
And it worked, you know. I didn't try and go in there and go, look, I am so French.
I mean, look at me.
look at this tweed frock coat I'm wearing.
Right. Okay. Well, it's very nice to have you back on the podcast. And
next
time you're in town, let me know and we'll go for a pint and
definitely
a podcast again.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. A pleasure.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you. Okay, so that was Ian Moore. Thank you again to Ian for being on the podcast. I won't talk a lot more here at the end because I don't want the episode to be too long, but I would like to say thanks again to Ian for being on the podcast. You can find out more about Ian on his website, ianmoore.info. And well done for managing to follow this entire conversation. I wonder how much you understood, how many little jokes and funny moments you picked up on. It might be worth listening again, and I wouldn't be surprised if the transcription team chose to transcribe this episode like they did with episodes 382 and 383. You can find those transcriptions in the Google Documents by clicking transcripts in the menu on my website. Also, on my website, you might see the word premium in the menu, and I highly recommend you click on that and consider signing up to get access to all of the premium content I've made. And there's over 70 episodes of content, either video or audio, and also all the new content that comes out regularly. Grammar, vocabulary, pronunciation lessons, PDFs that you can download, practice drills, tests, memory tests, and all sorts of other things. So that's it for now then. Have a fantastic day, morning, lunch, afternoon, late afternoon, early evening, mid-evening, late evening, and night. And I will speak to you again on the podcast soon. But for now, goodbye. Bye. 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 Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.